Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
So delighted to welcome our next guest, Abdullah Amir, to the podcast today. And I met Abdullah through my involvement with the Offenders with Personality Disorder pathway when he was leading the OPDB project at Swinford Hall. And what I really enjoyed about getting to know you, Abdullah, was a really thoughtful way of reflecting and bringing group dynamics into discussions at the meetings that we held where all of the clinical directors from the various different services came. And I thought you brought something really useful in terms of those group dynamics. And also you were often quite key in bringing issues around diversity into those discussions. And I think it's fair to say the group is quite dominated by white middle-class women. So actually to have any men there was always useful, but also the fact that you're a person of colour bringing some contribution in. And it's probably also worth saying at this point, for those who don't know what the OPDP is, it's not a nice name, but it was a stream of services intended to highlight a group of prisoners who weren't getting access to services. And so I think actually what happened was some different kinds of thinking got brought in by employing people within the NHS. So Abdullah, you came in as an NHS employee into Swinford Hall. So really delighted to welcome you to the podcast today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. It's a bit exciting.
So we wondered, Abdullah, whether you could just say a little bit about your journey into where you are now. You know, where are you working now and what your pathway's been?
Yeah, so I suppose it's a really curious thing that I didn't want to be a psychologist when I was in school. What I wanted to be was a chef.
Really?
And then, yeah. However, I don't think a chef was very much something that would be valued within my family structures. So it was actually, what am I going to do? And I was always drawn to psychology. And it's interesting because when I did my A-levels or chose my A-levels, I wanted to do psychology as an A-level. And I was told not to do it by my head of sixth form. And his reasoning for not to do it was that it was, funnily enough, it was full of feminists and you wouldn't want to be around feminists anymore. And at that age, at 16, I didn't really know what a feminist was. All I knew was that, oh gosh, it means I need to avoid it. And the reason why I make that point is it's curious how I've come around full circle. So I would very much class myself as a feminist in my approach towards psychology now, in any case. I'm now working within a men's medium secure unit, having left the Swinford Hall OPD post, and it's a lead position and it covers acute intensive care and a personality focus service as well. But my journey to psychology has been really peculiar in that I did neuroscience as an undergraduate, and as I was doing neuroscience I realized that actually I actually do like psychology. I don't really care if it's got feminists in there, even though I still didn't know at the age of 20 what a feminist was either then. And whilst I was doing my university, I became a teaching assistant. And I've always really been interested in learning in that way and how people learn. So there's a part of me that I went from being a teaching assistant to being a youth vending officer. And working with people on the fringes of society has always been something that I've been drawn to. And then eventually I thought, actually, no, I'm going to give this psychology thing a go. So I then went and did a master's and did further education, did my training. But throughout it all, I've been a youth worker as well, just to generate some money. In terms of getting onto psychology can be a real challenge, especially if you come from a working class background.
Yeah.
And it's interesting for me that whilst my parents inhabited a working class background culturally from India, they wouldn't be classed as working class people. But as migrants in the UK, they are. So the values that we held weren't necessarily traditional British working class values, but they were also the practical living conditions and the way we worked were. So I think that bridging of two, and now I tend to bring that into my work as well. So particularly when I was doing the OPD work, but also in general, the way I've started to really think about things has been, I bring a breadth of different cultural contexts. And that can really help me to think about what might be going on within groups and what different positions. So yeah, I suppose throughout all of that as well, my interest in working with ethnic minorities, both from a personal perspective and understanding my own psyche in that sense, I suppose, but also thinking about how ethnic minority communities engage with services has been really fostered with community psychology approaches. So my first paid assistant post was in Liverpool, and it was in a community psychology post working with refugees and asylum seekers. And I don't think I fully understood the stresses of doing that work, that I literally ran away from it. And it's one of my biggest regrets.
Well, yeah, when you say you ran away from it, I wondered if you could say a bit more about that.
Yeah, so it was a project working with refugees, asylum seekers and ethnic minorities in Liverpool. And it was an independently funded project. So it came from Health Action Zones, and then what then became Delivering Race Equality. And then there was an independent fund from the Parenting Fund. And what was happening was year on year, the project, which worked with Black British, Black African, Yemeni, Chinese and Turkish Kurdish communities. So it was independently funded, but managed by an NHS trust. And it was told year on year that actually there was no more funding. Therefore, we would have to tie up the work. And then right at the last moment, literally in March, so that would be the end of the financial year, we'd be told, oh, you've got some money now, you can run with it. And I think those pressures, which I believe were around the race and the political work that we were doing, created a lot of political tension. And what was happening within the team and the organization was the senior staff obviously knew about this, but the junior staff, of which I was one as an assistant psychologist and the administrator, weren't really aware of what was happening. But we knew something. And I did something that I have never done since and had never done before. And that was, I timed my annual leave to be 2 weeks. So I had to give 1 month's notice. So 2 weeks over Christmas, handed in my notice, went on 2 weeks annual leave, and then had 2 weeks to come back. And I think what that was me acting out on my unconscious anxiety about what was going on in the system and how the team and the organization, in consultation with the service users, so it was a service user-led project, had decided that this would be the final year we'd operate because we couldn't take the ups and downs anymore. It was becoming too challenging. Interestingly, there was a request for bids. A tendering process was released after we had closed exactly the same project. So it was like we were going to go through the same motions. And I think that was my first introduction to community psychology, but also how forces can act on people. And only with a space to reflect can you really think, oh, I don't think I was just running away from the work. The work I loved, I think I was running away from the bigger pressures, the political, social, political pressures that were bearing down upon me. So David Smale's work really influenced me in that way.
It's very interesting, isn't it? Because actually the work must have been quite heavy work in itself, just the face-to-face work. But then when you have the context of a political agenda and issues as well alongside that, that you can see how that'd be very weighty for anybody, really.
Yeah. And I think the thing about it is that that has been a seed that has, and that experience has been really strong in wherever I go now. So wherever I go, I'm really conscious of, why do I feel the need to change something or run away, or what's going on? What's making people shut down? And that with some of my foundation course training and things from the Institute of Group Analysis has really helped me to really process that. And I've really started to try and think that one thing that I really hold true to me is the work that we do cannot be divorced from the political, social, political context that we live in. And therefore we act out some things that we might not necessarily want to, or might be talking to or speaking to a broad political power. And having an understanding of that, the way I try to lead the team that I'm in now as well is them being aware of what those pressures might be, but also having an acknowledgement that sometimes we might not be able to do too much with it, but the awareness can help us work with it as opposed to act in ways which we wouldn't want to do.
Yeah, I was thinking that was a very interesting description, Abdullah, because it sounded, and maybe this is simplifying it a bit, sounds as if what you were saying was you became aware of some external process, some external dynamic. And initially in this original project that you were describing, you kind of acted something out. And through a learning process that you went through, you began to understand how it's possible to be aware and to understand and to act differently. Is that more or less what you're saying?
Yes, I think so, yes. And I think what was the biggest learning for me was that experience in Liverpool, I think, connected to my growing up experiences. So like I said to you, throughout university, I've always been interested in working with and understanding things and people who have been on the fringes of society. And I suppose growing up, I've grown up in a very traditional environment. I'm Indian, Gujarati, Muslim by background. And we've grown up in a very traditional environment. And I remember once I was in school and one of my friends had seen me over the weekend. And I was wearing, my dad wears traditional Islamic clothing, the shalwar kameez. And I was wearing one as well. And I remember my non-Muslim, non-Asian friends saying, "Ah, we saw you on the street. You were wearing a dress." And at that point, I recoiled in horror, like, oh my gosh, they think I'm wearing a dress. So even though I had seen them and they had seen me, I totally denied it. I was like, no, that wasn't me. I don't know who you're talking about. I wasn't even around that part of town. I don't know what you're talking about. And that really started to, after the Liverpool experience, I started to really think, actually, I've always had to deny parts of my difference to get by. And I think what Liverpool did was they really offered me an opportunity. The project was called Building Bridges, and it really offered me an opportunity to think about how my sense of self and my ethnicity wasn't a bad thing. Now, I'm not saying that actually I've always grown up with thinking that my ethnicity was a bad thing, because within my family home, we tended to celebrate and give Christmas presents and recognize Diwali and different cultural festivals. And because of that, I always knew that difference isn't always bad, but I just knew who I was. It was only those other smaller experiences where I thought, oh, I don't think people understand my difference as much. And when I got to Liverpool, I think it was a clash of both my personal and my professional in a way that I didn't really have a space to think. And only when I got distance away from it and through training and through therapy that I was starting to think, oh, so this is what may have happened, and this is how it may have contributed, that the experience in Liverpool touched in something which was quite a childhood anxiety as well, and how I was able to now marry the two together.
Mm. And they're a group, aren't they, which, you know, refugees, it's like you see the vilification in the, you know, the way that the media talk about refugees is just awful, isn't it? That kind of talk, you know, recently people dying and people are saying, well, we shouldn't be coming to England. And it's like, as if people are coming for a gravy train rather than recognising the circumstances with which people are in desperation when they leave, you know, and choose to take a boat across an ocean, a little dinghy across an ocean or what have you.
Yeah, and I think it's this really simplistic view, isn't it, of actually people are coming to take away things from us, as opposed to the empathy as to what are they coming away from and what are they moving towards. But also it's this, I think we've entered into this area and space where people are quite egocentric and it's only about their needs, and as long as their needs are met. And we see and hear stories. For example, there's the refugees and asylum seekers, but even closer to home for me, I'm really aghast at the use of food banks. And I distinctly remember, I can't remember who he was. I think it may have been Jacob Rees-Mogg or someone who had said, it's one of the proudest moments.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just thought to myself, well, I'm not entirely sure it is. And I think there's those fringes of society that we tend to overlook, and people who don't conform to what we want people to conform to, that we ignore until we suddenly feel like they're a problem. And I think that's what's drawn me to working with offenders as well. The idea that people don't really think about contextualizing what has happened. It's a really interesting process when people go, actually, children can do no bad and children can do no evil. But then suddenly you hit this age of competence and suddenly, bang, you're an evil person.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's always highlighted for me with, say, like the death of baby P, and people are rightly aghast at what happened to him. But then you take the individuals who killed Jamie Bulger and they're referred to as evil monsters, and you think, well, actually, the age difference is not that great. And actually, if you were to look at the histories of many of the people in prison who've committed the most severe offences, they are quite similar to what Baby P's experiences would have been. And I think we just really, really struggle with the fact that we're not very good at looking after children as society, are we? It's much easier to start looking for ways to blame the individuals rather than thinking about, if people are committing crimes, that's a function of a sick society, it's not an individual problem alone.
And I think I'd broaden that. I think we're becoming more and more separate, and we have become less and less inclined to care for people, let alone children. So recently, the Marcus Rashford, I don't know if you're aware, but the Marcus Rashford social media campaign is a brilliant example of ending child food poverty and how there are other priorities which have taken precedence to prevent that project from moving forward. And I think there's something around care that we're less willing to show care for others. And I think that's what the OPD service, well, certainly in Swinford, we really tried to engender this idea that if we can have a real good foundation of care first, we can then talk about these really challenging experiences, not just for the men that we work with in prisons, but also the staff, the brutality of what was happening. I remember we were having some renovations done in the prison, and there were these big corrugated iron walls put up with barbed wire over the top. And somebody said to me, an officer said to me that it reminds him of his time in Belfast during the Troubles. Uh-huh. And I thought to myself, wow, these are parts of histories that people have just shut off inside themselves. And there's a limited amount of care and nurturance that goes on within institutions and outside of institutions. And therefore, at an individual level as well, I find it really curious. I once said thank you to someone in my new post. When I started, I said thank you as they were leaving. And they went, what are you thanking me for? And I said to them, just for coming into work today and doing your thing. And they'd be like, okay, that's really strange. And I suppose for me, that saddened me, but also was a real curiosity. Wow, saying thank you for someone's work is a novel idea all of a sudden.
No, I don't know exactly what you mean. I got involved with a hobby outside of work, and meeting with this group of people regularly. It was a reading group, getting involved with people regularly who were thanking me when I'd organised something. I was like, wow, people don't normally say thank you for doing these basic tasks. I just saw that as being something to do. So you're right. I think there's something about forensic work which kind of brushes some of the soft edges off, doesn't it? And leaves you with a kind of like a harsher world that we all occupy. And maybe that's because we're all more stressed and kind of like running around and more pressured. I don't know. It's something to be curious about, I think, in terms of what, even those kind of like small, nice parts of life, we somehow skip or brush over.
I'm wondering, Abdullah, if we could move on and if you could tell us a bit about your work at Swinfen Hall and how you go about establishing a culture and a regime there which is positive.
So I think for me, when I was at Swinfen, and I've, obviously it will have changed since I've left, but when I was there, the thing that I walked into was a clinical team, so a staff group made of people employed by the NHS who had clinical backgrounds, and a staff group of officers. And they both got on relatively well amicably, but there wasn't really a space where people spoke to each other about the challenges. And I'm always really conscious when everyone is really nice to each other all the time, and all the badness is outside, it then really makes me question what's going on here.
Too cozy.
And I think, yeah, too cozy. It reminds me of my systemic family therapy training, that when somebody said to me that, if you have a happy family that comes to family therapy, there's some issues. Like, everyone can be happy all the time as a family unit. And that's just made me think. One of the things I like to think of all workplaces of as a family unit. So who are the parental figures, the primary caregivers? And then who are the children, the aunts, the uncles, the extended family and things like that? So the way I'd seen it was I was a parental figure and my counterpart on the prison officer side was another parental figure. And if us two were on the same page and we had the same, a good relationship, then we can then start to instill something within the group of staff that we were working with. However, I was also really conscious that I think the officer group there were often the containers for the anxious projections of the clinical staff. And the clinical staff had supervision really frequently and they were familiar with that. But I don't think the officers, whilst they had supervision in the clinical team, it was a new and novel experience to them. The service had been running for 2 years prior to I got there. And my aim was within the first 6 months was to build up a stronger relationship with the officers, because by nature of my training and my employer, I already had an affiliation with the clinical team. Now, there wasn't so much a split, but for me to create a culture of togetherness, I think it was really important to listen to, challenge at times, but really listen to the voices which are more subjugated. And that for me was the officers' voices. And there were times where we had arguments that I thought they were doing things which were blatantly out of order. But there was also something about giving them a space to know that they were cared for. And it's a really peculiar thing, because I have a friend of mine who wrote a really wonderful paper, Ian Simpson, about the role of reflective practice in the NHS. And that really struck a chord with me, because we were encouraging these officers to be reflective, but I was always really conscious about the impact it would have on their livelihood and what that would mean. And we went through this really, my relationship with the officers went through this really strange story arc, where I went in with this very hard line of, this is what it means to be ethical. This is what it means to be doing this work. And I realized I was imposing a whole set of values that didn't belong in the prison service. Not in the way that I enacted them. The values were there, but not how I acted them. So what we began to do was, or what I began to do was negotiate what were the behaviors associated with the values and how they mapped onto the values that I wanted. So something about care and something about understanding, but also something about expertise. I think there was, as we started to talk, I remember having a 2-hour session with two of the most experienced officers thinking about what the key worker role meant to them. And suddenly we had this huge diagram of all the things that they did. And they were like, we never really thought we could put it down like that. And I think by giving people a voice, what you then do is create an environment where their voice is valued. And then we regularly had reflective practice where I openly discussed my anger, my frustration, but also encouraged them to. So for me, it was about creating those communication and relationships and tolerating anger and also holding that projection of anger towards me and not acting into any of the splitting that may be occurring. And I'm not saying it was plain sailing, it was pretty difficult. But I think by the end of it, by the time I left, the team and the officers were in a position where they could communicate and they could openly disagree and then think through the disagreement. And for me, that is what's important. Not that everyone is on the same page and agrees with everything, but that we're all pulling towards the same thing.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, just that metaphor about the family, I think is so essential in caregiving services, actually, because that's where we get our schema for care from, isn't it? From our early experiences within the family. And so actually, if we can create that kind of context where people understand their role is the more senior staff to be the parental figures, but I guess, you know, for other staff being the big brothers or the big sisters that might also have a degree of responsibility for caregiving, but also be perfectly entitled to receive some care themselves. And then also, like you say, to be able to manage, at the end of the day, the, you know, our family members are often the people we have the most honest conversations with, or the we can manage the conflict because we know we love each other, so we can have that conflict and still come together as a group. And I share your sense of that's healthy as an environment, and certainly I would say that that's what how the Fens operate, is that family kind of model with a lot of disagreement at times. And I think sometimes outsiders come in and they're like, oh my god, I can't believe people are talking to each other in that kind of way, because we're being quite frank and open. But actually it's safe to do that because we know that we value the contribution that each person makes to the work that's going on. So it's coming from a good place when we're trying to resolve conflict and tensions.
And I think for me, it took a lot of learning for me as well. So if we were to extend the family metaphor, it was like a new partner had come in, into the household, and people were starting to forge relationships, and they didn't really know what this parental figure was going to be like, whether they were going to abandon them, whether they were going to stay with them. So there was a lot of that. But also for me, it really tapped into, and I said this in the service at the time, and I've said this in other arenas as well, for me it really tapped into how me as a Muslim man lives in a British society. And by that I mean, as an NHS employee hosted within the prison, I need to adhere to the prison rules. The prison rules were overarching. However, I was still going to live my values and my life within the prison as I would. So for example, in my personal life, that would look like, I won't drink and I don't eat non-halal meat, but I will still go out and eat and people will drink around me and that's fine. And just like in the prison, the things around me might be things that I don't agree with, but within my own little home, I would make sure that they would relate to my values without breaking the overarching values. And the curious thing about that is, it starts to open up a dialogue of difference again, about how do you work differently when everything around you is saying otherwise? And I hope what I was able to show is you can hold that conflict inside as long as you have your peers and your colleagues around you that all share that same kind of ethos, knowing and seeing something. So we started having conversations about how we do things differently and that's okay. That, once again, for me, taps into me growing up and going, actually, being different is okay. And sometimes it's not okay, and sometimes it is. Sometimes we'll get attacked for it, and being able to hold that within.
But it sounds like you're talking about belonging to the clinical group, if not the whole group all the time.
Yeah, having a foot in each camp. Mm. Yeah. And I think for the officers that was particularly difficult, but belonging, not necessarily to the clinical group, but belonging to something. So I think the identity, so I'm really interested in how identities develop. So it was, for me, it was really curious that I think we attracted staff that started to feel on the fringes. So officer staff that who started to feel on the fringes of the prison system, and that the prison system didn't quite fit with them. So they started to come towards another person or another group of people who were different. And for me, I think, as I was saying, I was thinking, actually, it's like a group of ragtag professionals that just come together and band together and do the work. But yeah.
I think it's so funny that you notice that, because certainly we've always felt like that in the FEMS unit, that what you get are people who, I'd say for the officers, really people who are quite unorthodox as officers in terms of being willing to experiment and be curious about different ways of being an officer to the old school kind of way of officers. And certainly as a clinical staff group, we would often laugh about the fact that we're a group of eccentrics that perhaps don't easily all fit together, aside from the fact that we all have those kind of like quirkiness in our ways of thinking, and then have this shared set of values that brings us together. But so I think there is something, I think to work in the prison system, I think what you seem to be highlighting is having to be comfortable with difference, and be able to kind of like acknowledge your own difference, but to be able to still find a bridge through to other people at the same time.
I was thinking that you're talking really about developing a culture of authenticity, so within your particular unit. And it reminded me, I've just finished reading the Odyssey. I go to a reading group and we've just finished reading through the Odyssey, and we do it by sitting around actually reading the book. Fascinating, takes a long time. But something struck me today, Athena talking to Telemachus, who's Odysseus's son. She says to him, rely on your heart and reason and any help you can get from any particular spirit. So she's saying, really, rely on your heart and reason. Don't go out there and do what you think other people want you to do. I wonder if you think that's a reasonable description of being authentic, and what are the kind of conflicts that could give rise to in a setting you've just been describing?
You know what's lovely and wonderful about that? I've just thought about that. Heart and reason, you said, right?
Mm, yeah.
Now, the wonderful thing about that is, for me, that speaks to everything which isn't Western psychology, right? That speaks to me about everything which is everything but Western psychology. And by that, I mean, it speaks to being connected with your heart, your body, your soul, and your mind, your thinking, your cognition. And we're moving into, with third wave CBT and things like that, cognitive behavior therapy, we're moving into this kind of integration. But it is, that is exactly what authenticity means to me, and what I try to engender within the people that I work with, even in my current role. The idea that actually, if you are passionate about something and you know that you love it for reasons of, for want of a better word, social justice and care and what is right and good and higher order working, along with you know the theory of why you're doing, then that is a job worth pursuing. And I won't stand in the way, I'll support it. I might not fully understand it, but I'll support it. And it is about authenticity for me. It's interesting that you pick up on that. Other people will know that when I teach or when I'm presenting, I always present a quote by Jim Jarmusch, where he talks about nothing is original, and authenticity is invaluable. And I think for me, it's a longer quote, and I really encourage the listeners to go and seek it out. But for me, I think I like, because of my own culture around, it's a hybrid of my Britishness, my Englishness, my psychologiness, my Muslimness, and everything else that is within me. I like to think of things as, where am I selecting things from? And how do they fit together to be something that connects with other people? And within the prison, if I could show people, and within any of the services, if I could show people that this is what resonates with me, that doesn't mean it's true, but this is what I'm bringing, what are you bringing? I think that's why the staff got to a position where there was creativity, there was a togetherness, because people who use the services, the men who use the services as well, they recognize that actually, I won't tolerate for sexism or homophobia and things like that, and racism. But I will allow them to express a view as long as it could be challenged and then thought upon. And that for me is about authenticity.
Somebody once said to me that they felt it was, a person of colour said they felt it was harder to really fully be themselves within a friendly environment. I wonder, do you think people of colour face more challenges to being able to be in those environments as their authentic selves to other groups?
Yes. The short answer would be yes, but I think yes.
We probably all agree that actually the more authentic you are, the easier it is to be well and healthy as you go about, whether it be work or in your personal life. And so that's a shame if people are, well, more than a shame, but you know, it feels pretty dreadful if people are going to work and face those extra barriers to authenticity, and whether you have any thoughts on how that can be changed.
Yeah, I suppose one of the things about it is that I said to you before that actually I was growing up as a Muslim within British culture, right? And having an understanding right from birth that I was different and how to manage and cope with those differences. But also when you go into the workplace, you enter another domain, and there's a lot of chat about code switching at the moment and knowing when to be your more aligned to your authentic self and when to be not. And I think we all do it in varying degrees, but people of colour end up doing it more because of how their difference can be perceived. So particularly within forensic units. So within forensic units, there's this idea that uniformity is key. Everyone must be the same, do the same, and act the same. And individuality is not really, in my experience, valued. So people will express their individuality in various ways through hair color and things. But I always find it really curious that people of color can't not express their individuality, because the first thing you see is their skin color difference. Mm-hmm. So what I started to do was learn the language of the people around me and know when to use that language and in which organization and teams and meetings to use that language, but occasionally drop in something of my own self and then test the water of how that was received. And it's interesting, I'm talking about this. Over the last week, I've been talking about it with people of colour within my current place of work and talking about the idea of what the burden of the ethnic minority is in a professional environment, what the person of colour has to endure. And that is being aware of what might be seen as located in their ethnicity, whilst also being aware of what is acceptable to the community in which they work. And it wasn't just at work I was talking about this. I was at the gym with a colleague and a friend, and he was saying, this is something that we've had to do all our lives. It's not something that just happens with work. So it becomes automatic. The problem is that the energy it takes to constantly do that, you then have to have the additional energy when you're working with people who have really traumatized backgrounds in forensic units. You then also have to have the additional energy to tolerate and manage that. Mm-hmm. And I think that can sometimes take its toll. And the way I've had to nurture myself is in really childlike ways. So sometimes I'll, especially as I've got more senior with more power, I've been able to do this. So really talk about what is my ethnicity and show and say, actually, no, that is not what I agree with. Once somebody turned around and said to me, we'll have a shared lunch. This is pre-COVID, obviously. We'll have a shared lunch and then we'll have some cheese at the end. And I was like, I don't know many Asian folk that have cheese at the end of their dinner. that's not something. Give me some like really sweet food and that'll be fine. But not cheese. That's not the kind of thing we do. But I can have those kinds of jokes. But also, in the background, have connections with people who are different in many forms, not just ethnicity, but ethnicity particularly, and connect with them of, oh my gosh, this just happened, or oh my gosh, this just happened at work. How would you do it? So having a source where our ethnicity is nourished and we're not diminishing it too much, otherwise you can lose yourself in the system. And I think the way I've navigated it often has been, who are the people that nourish my ethnicity, but also every other element of my difference, including the difference in my thinking?
I'm really struck by something you've said a bit earlier, Abdullah. And I should say that I was talking with Naomi just before we started and told her that I have a great, or had a great grandmother who was Indian, born in India. But of course, I've never experienced any racial pressure or racial prejudice at all, apart from twice in Berlin, in Germany, once when I was thought to be Turkish and once when I was thought to be Jewish, and I was abused both times. But I've had an extremely fortunate and privileged life. But I was really struck by something you said about, you know, the weight of the burden of having to deal with the issues of diversity and difference all the time, and just how much kind of mental and emotional energy that must be consuming.
I think I've come to understand that more in the last 5 or 6 years. Prior to that, I remember when I was an assistant psychologist, somebody observed it in me, and they said to me whilst we were having lunch, Abdullah, you're always switched on. You're always watching and you're always switched on. And my response at the time, I can still remember who said it and what I said. I said to them, yeah, but that's because I have to be. And I didn't really understand what I meant at that point. I just knew that I had to be. And I think it's about internalizing these messages that actually, even when I grew up, my parents raised me with the idea that I had to work double hard just to be seen as good as my counterparts from white British culture. But within that as well, there have been moments where I've seen and experienced my friends working double hard and not having the same opportunities, but also when they express something which is challenging to the system, it being labeled as being part of their lack of understanding of the culture of the organization. And when we really drill down as to what that might mean, people target the idea that because they're of a different ethnicity, they wouldn't really get the organization, even though they might be British born ethnic minorities, but they just don't get it apparently. So somebody once said to a family member of mine that they didn't fit. They love the work, they're really enthusiastic, but their face didn't fit. And it was only through conversations with a colleague of theirs that my family member learned that it was mainly because they're a bearded Muslim. And in that particular organization, it wasn't going to work. A bearded Muslim wasn't going to get promoted. And I think there's something around the idea that when you work in institutions like prisons and forensic units, more so in prisons than I think mental health units, but within prisons particularly, you realize that you're one of the few members people of colour. There aren't many around, and therefore the burden becomes you have to be the best. Otherwise, you're speaking for your own ethnicity, the whole culture. And I think with regards to being a Muslim as well, and a bearded Muslim at that, I think there's something holy around in prisons, making sure you don't ever sound like you're a terrorist. And now it's got to the point for me where I will say, I'm going to say this, but it's going to be challenging, but that doesn't mean I hold extremist views. And just to clarify that, just in case people get the wrong idea. And I think that can be something which, once again, society gets into us, the idea of what it means. And that happens with ethnicity, that happens with sexuality. So I always find it a really curiosity that no one ever comes out in prison if you're a male. But if you're female, that's okay. So there's these kind of things that, what does it mean to be different, and how do those differences really impact upon people?
Absolutely. And again, it takes us back to that authenticity thing, doesn't it? If there's parts of you that are not easily able to be there, then actually you have that strain alongside the just the demands of hearing details of people's offending or being on the receiving end of a barrage of verbal abuse. You've also got the interpersonal conflict, the intrapersonal conflict going on at the same time, potentially. You know, just struck by that burden of having to front load a statement with I do not hold extremist views, and the fact that I would never even have to, I can't imagine the circumstances with which I would have to say that. You know, just what a weightiness that is to carry.
Yeah, I think I have a brilliant example of this. So in the prison, one of the people that we worked with decided he wanted to convert to Islam. And I was the head of the service. So I remember having a conversation with my staff team saying, we need to really handle this sensitively. Because if we don't, what's it going to look like if the head of the service, who's a bearded Muslim, and suddenly there's a service user who has converted to Islam? It's going to be like they're indoctrinating. And people were like, no, it happens in prison all the time. I was like, no, we really need to be conscious of this. So I will have to have a real conversation about what my contact is like when I'm with them, what it might mean. And I ended up having this conversation with the person as well, the offender then as well, about why I might be more distant and what it might look like and what that might be about. So yeah, it's constantly there in regards to that.
It was very, very weighty.
It is. It was, I think, during my time at Swinton, that was one of my most anxious moments.
Yeah.
Because, especially within this current social political climate, that is the worst thing that I think I could endure. I think that is the thing that I would find most challenging. Racism, I've been able to tolerate it and work with it and challenge it. But I think the subtleties of, for want of a better word, Islamophobia there, would be something that I think I'd find overwhelming. So there, I once again, I had to really open myself up to the team and say, these are my anxieties. And the way I did it was I half joked about it, but I was at other times really quite serious. So the jokes were about, you do realize what it looks like with a bearded man as a head of service. And then during reflective practice say, it actually makes me quite anxious. I can't just keep going to talk to him as I would with any of the other guys. But then that impacts upon his development. So it is a really weighty hit. And the way I got through it was my colleagues having those open conversations.
So you're highlighting two important things in terms of that well-being and resilience, I guess, around being able to be comfortable with your own vulnerability and being able to share that, but also having good supportive colleagues who do know you and where it's possible to express that vulnerability without putting yourself in a more stressed situation. But talking a lot about the kind of like the challenges around to well-being around being a person of colour, but I wondered whether the offside of that is whether that brings any additional strengths in terms of resilience? So, you know, the idea that resilience is a bit of a muscle that we have to practice weightlifting with in order to kind of like increase our resilience, rather, so it's a process rather than something you have or don't have. And I wondered whether having faced those kind of challenges in other parts of your life, whether that brings resilience into forensic settings.
Yes, it does. I always think about the word resilience and what we mean by that and how it can be politicized, operationalized, an attack. But I think it does. What it does, it gives me experience. The resilience comes from experience. But also, it's when you, for me, having lived through that, so not just worked through it, having lived through it, there's something about who has really nourished me and who has kept me grounded in who I am and keeping access and contact with that. And I encourage this a lot of my team, not in a kind of there's something problematic or pathologizing in them, but there's therapy has been really helpful to have a space, but also a mentor. So I've had a mentor since I was an assistant psychologist, and having those spaces to really connect with the different parts of myself and explore the different parts of myself and be okay with that, not necessarily publicly talk about every element, not necessarily let people into everything or use it. But I think knowing myself has allowed me to know that actually it's okay to be wrong in parts. And it takes me back to the idea of David, when you were talking about creating a culture of openness in the team. I think for me, the resilience part comes from, as I've developed professionally throughout, I've tested the water with speaking about points of difference, and then how it was received challenged it a little bit more. And in some ways, I've been fortunate people in the main have received it well. And I imagine that's also because I'm a male and I can be quite assertive. I imagine if I was female, it would feel different. But there is something about these people who have opened and created opportunities for me that I hold them in my heart. And I hold them close to me about the idea that actually these are the people that have allowed me to grow. And therefore, if I get something wrong, I can go back and have a conversation with them or connect with other people. So there is something about embracing my vulnerability. Don't get me wrong, it's absolutely petrifying at times. But there is. Somebody once said to me, I gave a presentation about working with difference and ethnicities and group and organizational dynamics. And somebody said, you come across really confident. And dare I say it, a little bit arrogant at times. And I said to them, well, I don't think it is arrogance. It might be, but I don't think it is. I think it's because now I know what I don't know about myself. And now I know what my vulnerabilities are. I'm able to sit with those and talk to the strengths that I have, but keep those vulnerabilities to myself. Whereas I think what we can get into when I was more fresh in my career, I think I thought everybody could see my vulnerabilities and they would exploit them. And I think that comes from being an ethnic minority, but also anxious to be a high achiever and work hard. So a combination of things.
So you've given us an answer to a question that's going around in my mind, or at least I think you've given us part of an answer, because I'm still interested to know what it is in you, in your background, who was it that has given you, a relatively young man who's achieved a great deal in life already, has given you the confidence to take those steps, which must have felt very risky and dangerous at times.
Stories are always really important to me. So I suppose now would be a good time to tell a story that I haven't said yet. And that is my grandparents on both sides, personally, were quite, and it makes me slightly emotional thinking about them. Sadly, they've passed away, but they were really forward thinking. So my paternal grandfather set up the first girls' Islamic school in India. And it's a big school with international students coming in, because he believed, and this was back in the late 70s, he believed in the importance of Islamic education for women as well as other education. And my maternal grandfather came to the UK, set up his own business, but also set up and built up a local Muslim charity and a mosque. But what they both did was that they really engaged with the community around them, regardless of whether they were the same members of the community. So regardless of whether you're Indian Muslim, it became that you engage with everyone and you do so with an open heart. I suppose that would be the first step in which those stories of, I used to go out balloting with my grandfather when I was a child, posting leaflets through people's post boxes. I remember really important religious figures coming into my grandfather's home and him entertaining them in a humble home as well, but to do so. And I remember sitting there thinking, that's the kind of person I want to be. But then within my professional career as well, having people who nurtured me, who allowed me to express my voice, even though my voice could be dissenting. And once again, we come back for me to that parenting analogy. I think I've had good parents in both professional and personal perspectives. So there have been psychologists who have really challenged me and said that I'm doing things wrong, but done so in a really exploratory way. So I think that has been a real strength for me, a touchstone kind of, actually always go back to those experiences and those attachment almost. But within that as well, I think it's taken me a while to get comfortable with who I am and in knowing who I am and what I stand for. And also acknowledging that just because I think something is right doesn't make it right. In an overused clip, probably nowadays, Chimamanda Adichie, who is a Nigerian author, feminist author, has done a TED talk, and then she's written a book, Why We Should All Be Feminists. But her TED talk is on the dangers of a single story. So I remember telling you about the Liverpool Building Bridges project. That introduced me to narrative therapy, which introduced me to the idea that there isn't a single story to be told. There's multiple stories. And I think that's the bit that really connects. When we spoke about authenticity, that really connected with my story. The idea that actually, just because there's these flying narratives about, doesn't necessarily mean they're the narratives that I have to buy into. The narratives that I think are true to me are what's important. But within that, my group analytic thinking comes in as well, where I start to think about, where is the anxious projection? So why would I be told that I'm a bad person, or there is a part of me that is, what function does it serve? Whose anxiety is it? And more recently, I've come to terms with the idea that actually, I said something to a group of people a couple of weeks ago, that if you had bilingual psychologists, everyone would think they were a rare resource and wonderful. Yet within the world of psychology, if you're bicultural, that's not really valued as much. So it's a really peculiar thing that at what point do you really start to become aware of my ethnicity, my difference, whatever it might consist of, isn't necessarily a weak point. It's actually quite a strength. And being able to nurture that and have that space.
I think that theme of kind of like difference being a strength, I think, is one of the problems when, you know, organisations, institutions take on wanting to address diversity and be more inclusive. And how that often gets depicted is it's as if it's only of interest to the people who are not the normative group. So it's people of colour, or it's homosexual people, or it's women that will benefit from that, rather than actually organisations are all strengthened by people being able to be themselves within that, rather than it becoming a niche issue for the target group.
I think you're right. And this might be me performing cognitive tricks and things, but I'm also really curious that, once again, I think that comes down to, if you've grown up in a world where what you do is okay right from the get-go, and what you do is right from the get-go, no matter what you do, then you're going to find it really hard to think, maybe there's a different way of doing this, and invest in that, because it wouldn't serve your needs. So what we're talking about essentially is power. You're in a position of power. Why would you choose to absorb that or relinquish that power? And I think what we try to do within OPD services particularly, but also in general forensic settings, is bring live those conversations about power and how there are abuses of power, which often forensics results in, but also how people may consciously and unconsciously choose not to engage with something because it gives up their power. So if we take any form of diversity training, the reason why it usually happens is because people feel it fulfills a tick box, a need. Therefore, attend your diversity training, you're not going to get done for being and discriminatory in that way. However, if we really wanted to think about how you engage with diverse communities in all the characteristics, and with that, even though it's not a protected one, I also think about socioeconomic class in that as well. That means we actually have to give up a little part of ourselves and share a little part of ourselves. But that means vulnerability. And vulnerability in forensic institutions usually means assault, or the fear of assault, whether it be psychic or actual physical. And I think that's where the challenge lies, that diversity initiatives will only really succeed if everyone is on board. And if everyone is on board, that means we need to accept that there will be psychic assaults and physical assaults when we're vulnerable. But if we can just help get through it,
I think that's such an interesting point. I suppose I'm not even convinced that it does mean actual assaults. I think the problem is that within forensic institutions, people are left feeling vulnerable, and because we defend against that in forensic institutions, the assumption is there. You know, when you don't think straight, do you, when you're anxious and feeling vulnerable? So the assumption is therefore you must be more at risk physically, there's more danger. When in fact the vulnerability might be about something much more subtle, but because we don't highlight work on diversity and inclusion, creating that sense of vulnerability, it feels a little bit like it's almost a bit doomed to failure, because we're not letting people know what's ahead of them. Does that make sense?
That does. I suppose that does make sense. I think telling people what's ahead of them means talking about history and where things have happened in the past. Mm. And that once again means opening wounds. And I think people are really afraid to do that, really afraid. And when I say physical assaults, I don't necessarily mean being beaten up or being assaulted in that way. I also mean physical assault as being dismissed, using things around how being ostracized, being excluded, and being physically. So I remember once in one team I was working in, they decided they'd all stop talking to a member of staff, just stop talking to them because they had expressed a difference in opinion about something. And I walked into this team to help them reflect. And I was like, so we pride ourselves on being caring, yet there's a member of staff who is literally on the outside of this circle. What's going on here? And I think that kind of physical maneuvering can also happen. But yeah, you're right. I think sometimes it's the fear of the physical assault that can be grand. While you were talking, I was thinking, within forensic institutions, there's the anxiety of that, but there's also, I think, the anxiety of potency. And by that, I mean that the fear that actually my anger is going to be so potent, I'm going to annihilate and destroy. So if you, I had to think that if you diminish yourself to such an extent, I think you will also start to generate a lot of anxiety and energy through anger. And sometimes the fear of being totally annihilated, your sense of self being annihilated, can result in this huge annihilation or fear that you'll annihilate everything around you. And most of the people that I've come across within forensic institutions tend to be really caring people. However, if you're constantly met with these kinds of experiences, you can lose that element because you can get consumed. So I think one of the biggest things for me is, whilst there's anxiety, there's also something around, and anxiety in the sense of a more uncertainty, unknowingness. There's also a knowingness of how angry you can become. And I think I have often, I think I did that once in my time at Swinford, where I became so angry, I'll admit to this in the public sphere, I hatched a plan to annihilate another member of staff, right, who wasn't on my team, another member of the prison staff, where I thought, what do I need to do to trap them and then expose them in a very public way? And it's one of those things that you learn that actually that wasn't the best thing. It may have changed something, but it wasn't the best thing. And it wasn't something that I would normally do. It isn't something that I would ever choose to do again. But I think that for me really spoke to the idea that when I feel that there's nowhere to express my difference of opinion, not about myself, but about work, how it can come out in this aggressive way. And that's why I think there's very little difference in the way clinical and operational staff within OPD services work, because we're all humans that engage in the same processes, but there's different airs of superiority and things that go on in power.
Yeah, really thought-provoking. Just a total tangent, I'm just really want to ask you about faith, actually, because you obviously come from a background with a strong faith heritage there, and I wondered whether that played a role in well-being and resilience for you.
Faith is something really interesting. My faith is one of the most private parts of myself, yet also one of the first things that you'll know about me. So I always attend Friday prayers. I always fast during Ramadan. It's a very private thing, but also inevitably it becomes very public because of the nature. I have a beard and things like that. It is a resource. It is a huge resource. However, I spoke about the idea of what it might mean if I use it within work and the fear of being seen as radicalizing or something like that. But also, it's only more recently in the last 3-4 years that I've got really comfortable with speaking openly about it and speaking about the idea. And that for me, once again, comes from a faith belief system. So one of the pillars within Islam is charity. So the way I think of it is my charity comes from giving information about myself, which dispels the myth that Muslims are all violent individuals. So one of the things that I think, and I've had feedback, is that people can talk to me about my faith without feeling chastised or embarrassed. And I like to open that up because it does give me something which settles me, my faith, but it gives me something which is just private. It's between me and myself, my family at times as well, but mainly me and myself. And I think that when we speak about resilience, that's the part that really feeds my resilience. I always need something which is for me and not for anyone else. And that's where faith comes in. That is purely for me. And within work environments, for example, I'll go down to the multi-faith room and I'll pray and things like that. And I'll tell people that I'm doing that. But more often than not, I won't. More often than not, I won't tell them, because partly of a fear of what it might look like, but also partly because it brings others into the part of my mind which is for me and solace and thoughtfulness. And in that moment, I just want me to have some clarity about my own thoughts. So that introspection. So for me, faith has been important that way. But also, once again, I spoke about my grandparents. Because of their faith, their positioning on faith, I think it roots me in my heritage and my family. And it, once again, makes me think of being connected. So once I've done the pilgrimage, the Hajj, and I think one of the most beautiful moments for me, people often talk about the idea that actually when you see the Kaaba, the black cube, it's a really overwhelming experience for a lot of people. And that was a really amazing experience for me. But the thing that really touched me was there's a moment where you walk between two sites and everyone is dressed the same. Everyone. There's no watches that look really expensive or clothes or flash cars. And I think for me, and I did that when I was back in 2011, I think, the big pilgrimage, the Hajj. And I think for me, what I always come back to is that moment of realization of going, look at all these people from all over the world that at the end of the day, we're all going towards a similar kind of process. And I hold that in mind when I'm starting to think about the idea of when I work with people who have offended and people who have broken rules, mm-hmm. that actually I'm one step away from breaking a rule and who knows where I might end up. And therefore, there's something about not necessarily bringing faith into my work that way, but holding in mind that underneath the things that people have done, we're pretty much equals. So that's faith for me, I think.
Beautifully humbling.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I'm thinking about time too. I feel we could carry on talking with you for hours, Abdullah, and it's been amazing, the kind of stream of thought and perspectives that you've brought to us today. So we're very grateful for that. There was one last thing. We like to ask people if you can nominate something, a person, a paper, a book that's particularly inspired you in your life.
Let me have a think. Because it's, there are things that really come to mind. I know what I'm going to pick. I know exactly what. Yeah. Hans Christian Andersen.
Right.
Fables. That or, yeah, let's go with that. And the reason why I've picked that is my mother used to read that to me when I was a child. And she used to read that to me and my siblings. And I've still got the original copy. And it was interesting, funnily enough, and it connects to Swinfen. Because whilst I was at Swinfen Hall as well, we took on a drama therapist who started to use fables in her work as well. And throughout, this actually speaks, this might be a bigger discussion, right? But it speaks to me around one of the things that we spoke about resilience. One of the things that I really try and hold on to is my childlike behaviors. I always think it's really important to nurture my inner child. So I often talk about how my life is bookended by cake and chocolate and how I like to be playful. And even in as a consultant psychologist right now, you can ask any of my current team members, I am very playful. I'll play pranks, I'll play jokes and things like that. And I'll encourage them to do so as well. And a little, this might be very, very, this might give you an insight into my mind. When I look at people, I like to think of them as what they might have been like when they were children and how I would have connected with them in school, when I was at school, and how I would have been friends with them. And I think this all comes back to my childhood and Hans Christian Andersen and the stories, but also around that's how I stay true to who I am, connecting with my inner child.
Such a lovely conversation with you, Abdullah. And even though I knew you before, I feel like I heard so much more about you today in terms of layers of you as a person. Really, really interesting and, yeah, very thoughtful, thought-provoking. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much indeed.
That was a really nice, thought-provoking conversation with Abdullah, wasn't it? I think the thing that really stood out for me was the use of that family metaphor, because it resonated with Lorna Rhodes' interview, the conversation we had previously, where she spoke about Mr. Larson's presence within the unit and the fact that he went around every day. And, you know, I think that quite often institutions don't understand the need for the strategic leaders to have such a presence within the unit. But actually, if you're not visibly present and available within the service, you effectively set up families where either the parents are absent or you have a single parent family. And actually, there's some real strengths in having two solid parents or more, you know, being there to manage the emotions of people who are quite distressed.
Yeah, I agree. And I've actually listened to the podcast since we recorded it, and it really bears a second and third reading, actually. It's full of depth. I thought he was very open about so many things. At the beginning, he was talking about his time in Liverpool, and I thought it was a wonderful description, really, of his developing awareness of so many things, particularly the social and political and the psychological world that he was living in. He described that so well. Now, the other thing I liked was his mention of the comment from Jim Jarmusch that nothing is original. And I thought it was so good to hear that, because that used to trouble me a lot when I was young. I really thought everything I did or said should be original, which of course stopped me from doing practically anything. And I wish I'd kind of had that kind of awareness then. In fact, I always thought I should know everything, which again was a bit of a handicap, because it meant that I couldn't ask questions. It was good that Abdullah was able to describe so clearly how he came face to face with so many difficulties and issues in his work, and he worked his way through them by thinking about them deeply and using the kind of skills and knowledge and experience that he got both from his family background, which was extraordinary, actually, the way he described his family, and the various kinds of training that he'd had. And of course, at the end, he described something, again, with tremendous honesty, about how occasionally he gets angry with people and with events, and he has to struggle to manage his anger. And of course, we've all had, I'm sure, well, speaking for myself, I know I've had similar experiences, so it's good to hear him talking so honestly and openly about it.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.